You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
My name is Joseph Liao. I'm the Lee Kuan Yew Chair and Senior Fellow in Southeast Asian Studies at Brookings. I've been here a year. I'm from Singapore. I've been here a year. And one thing I've learned is Southeast Asia, as far as DC is concerned, can basically be summarized into two issues. One, South China Sea, and two, Myanmar. I am, of course, like I said, from Singapore, so in the spirit of the ASEAN way, I shall refer to it as Myanmar. So this morning, we're going to cover 50% of the Southeast Asian issues that keep DC awake at night, and that is Myanmar, more specifically the elections that have just taken place. Quite a tremendous result, and I think quite portentous of a whole range of issues which we hope to be able to unpack, discuss, and analyze today. To help us do that, we have a very distinguished panel, four speakers who are really experts on the topic at hand. We will have Ong Din, who will start first. He was a former political prisoner in Myanmar between 89 and 93. So he's he comes with that particular angle in mind as well. And he is currently based in San Francisco, I believe. Oh, you're based in D.C. Okay, with the U.S. campaign for Burma.
No.
Oh, no. Okay. Okay, well, the CV needs to be updated. But in any case, we are very pleased to have you here with us and to share your thoughts. We also have Priscilla Clapp. Priscilla has a very distinguished diplomatic career, including serving as basically the ambassador to Burma for one period. Now she is following, I think, with great interest, the peace process, and she will share with us some of her thoughts, among other things, about the implications of the elections, perhaps for the peace process. Yes, and she is currently with USIP. Then we have Renaud Aguito, who is currently a visiting fellow at the Institute of Southeast Asian Studies in Singapore. Did I get that right?
I was.
You. Okay. He was. And he was with ISIS as well as CERI in Paris. And he will talk to us about some of the issues related to the parliament, both the current parliament and the incoming parliament, which we would all be very excited to see in terms of the profile and how it will operate. And last but certainly not least, my good colleague Lex Riffle, who I know is a non-resident fellow, senior fellow at Brookings, and he has done extensive work on especially economics and financial structuring in Myanmar, and he will share with us some thoughts on that angle as far as it relates to the elections and more broadly to political change in the country. So because we have limited time and we have four speakers, can I request that they confine their remarks to about 10 minutes each, and then we can have an open discussion. So I'll start with Ong Din, please.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Thank you very much for being here today. I also would like to thank to the Brookings Institutions for having this very important panel discussion about my country, Myanmar. And also thank you very much to Les Riffle for inviting me to speak here. And I'm very honored to be here with my fellow distinguished panelists. And I was born and raised in Burma, also known as Myanmar. So since I became 18 years old age, I have seen three elections in the country. The first two elections were in 1982 and 1986. But at that time, elections were conducted under the socialist regime. There is no competitors. The candidates were appointed by the socialist party. And then there are only two ballot boxes inside the polling station. One is a white box for the positive box, and then another one is a black box for the negative box. And in the polling station, there is no secret voting, so people can see who where you vote. So that's why I choose not to vote in the last two elections in another socialist region. And there was a multi-party general elections in 1990, but I was not allowed to vote because I was in the jail. So I was eager to see when 2015 election is coming. I wanted to see how election will conduct. I wanted to see how our people will vote. I wanted to see how our candidates will campaign. So with such an enthusiasm, I plan to make my visit to Burma to coincide with the 2015 elections. So I went to the Yangon in Myanmar on the October 14th. I came back from Yangon on the November 17th. I stayed there for 33 days. So before the election, on the election day, and 2 days after the elections, I learned a lot. Since I arrived to Yangon, I visited many cities in the Yangon region. And then I went to Manali, and then I visited many cities around Manali regions. And then I went to Northern Shan State, Pingulin, Naocho, Dipo, Chao Mea, Lashio. So these are cities of the Northern Shan State. And I came back to Yangon, and I make another visit to the Delta, to the Pathay. And I came back, and then I spent most of the days, few days before the elections in Yangon, meeting with many people, checking with the, talking with the many candidates. Most of them are our friends who we worked together in the 1988 Popular Democracy Movement. So then, based on my observations, I predicted that in this election, National League for Democracy Party, led by Aung San Suu Kyi, will win the largest number of seats, but not enough to found the government. I also predicted that ethnic political parties will win majority seats in their ethnic states, and they will have the significant power to bargain with the major political parties. And then I was wrong. On the election day, when we saw the result, the NLD wins at landslide victory, like it did in 1990s. So I underestimated the popularity and influence of Aung San Suu Kyi. I also underestimated the magnitude of anger and hatred of the people keeping inside their hearts and minds for many decades against the Burmese military. So this election proved that this election result is actually the people of Burma quietly struck back against the Burmese military. When I compare the candidates between the NLD and the Union Solidarity and Development Party, USDP, I found two distinguished factors. I can describe the NLD candidates as young, educated, inexperienced, and unknown. Young, they are young. They are well-educated. But they don't have any kind of experience in the public office because NLD has never chance to rule the country. And they are unknown. This unknown factor has made me a lot of concerns. They are unknowns among the local population because many candidates of the NLD were sent by the party central committee to this particular region. Then the local branches in many of the NLDs, some of them were don't want to campaign for these people who came down from the top. So it was my great concern. Because of they are unknown among the local population, and they might have enough support from the local branches, and they might lose. This led me to my prediction that NLD will not win large and significant enough seat to form the government. Also, I look at the USDP candidates. They are old, well-educated. their experience, because they came from the military, they came from the current, they are current office holders, so they are well experienced in running the country. And they are well known. But this well known factor made them lose again election. Because they are not well known in a good way. They are well known in a bad way. They are well known for their arrogance, their corruption, their links to the cronies, okay. Their links to the previous military junta. That's why they lose it. They lose in the campaign. And also look at their campaign activities. The USDP candidates, they are very, very rich. They can spend so much money. They are actually rolling out the monies, cash, and presents to their constituents to persuade to buy the votes. And some of them are actually making inappropriate remarks during their campaign. For example, the Teo, who is the leader of the USDP, make a comment in the campaign that his comments about the President Obama's visit to Burma. He said that because of the transformation of the country led by the USDP party, US President Obama came to Burma twice. Yeah, it was right. But he says again that because of he came twice, he was kissed twice. That means that President Obama kissed on the cheek of Aung San Suu Kyi when he came to the country. He highlighted the point that showing that Aung San Suu Kyi was not enough to get respect from the majority of the population. But it was kind of inappropriate comments. Later he apologized, but he did it already. Also, the one of the USDP leaders, U Myang Yin, he mentioned about the color. USDP color is the green. The NLD color is the red. So he said that red. He compared the color of the red with the bloodshed. He mentioned to the explosion in the Madras mausoleums during the 1980s. And there was a bombing, and there was a lot of bloodshed. These were wrecked. So he compared the color of wreck to the bloodshed of the bombing. So such a comments were made by these USDP leaderships. That is why they lose in the election. They don't know how to convince the people, and they don't know how to get support from the people. They are arrogant. They think that using their powers and their money, they can get the votes from these people. But now they are wrong. So basically, NLD wins a big victory. NLD can found the government because it occupies about 60% of the seats in the Union Parliament, which includes the 25% of seats reserved for the Burmese military. NLD were found the 14 states and regional governments, and NLD were control the 12 states and regional parliament. So it is the big win for the NLD. Also, it is a big victory for the people of Burma. On the night of the election, I met with many friends, my childhood friends. Some of them are businessmen. Some of them work for the government. So we met together at the night of the election. They showed me proudly their little finger with a stain with a bubble ink. They said they have done their job. They were very proud of it. And then we decided to celebrate. And then we drive around the city, look for the restaurant, look for the liquor store. But all shops, all liquor stores, we are closed because the Yarangon regional government issued an order asking all the people not to sell liquor and not to close all the restaurants. So we could not find the restaurant, we could not find the liquor store, we could not make celebration. Then one of my friends said that he is actually deputy director at one of the government department. See, this government still restricting our freedom. That's why I didn't vote for them. So let me stop here, and my goal is to continue other parts of the election and future. And I will wait for your questions after that. Thanks a lot.
Thank you. Priscilla, please.
Thank you very much for that colorful report from the elections front. I had a feeling that the USDP campaign wasn't going to go down well with the people, and I'm glad to hear that it didn't. I am going to look at what the election means for the peace process. I'm going to speculate on that because I don't know. Nobody knows. starting with where we are right now, the peace process negotiator has been Minister Aung Myint. And he didn't win his election, so he will not be in the government or the parliament the next time around, as far as I can tell. However, he is back at work trying to keep the peace process moving forward. On October 15th, they succeeded in signing the national ceasefire agreement that they've been negotiating for almost 2 years, but only 8 out of, I think, 17 of the negotiating armed ethnic groups signed it, which is not even half. Moreover, the ones that did sign were the smallest, among the smallest. The ones that didn't sign are many, many times larger in terms of number of troops and territory. And the ones that didn't sign, many of them are still fighting with the army. So the effect of signing the national ceasefire has really not been felt. What the peace negotiators, the facilitators, wanted to do was go ahead with the signing and start putting all of the details in place that would implement a ceasefire agreement. That is, monitoring arrangements and negotiating a framework for a political dialogue that they hope to start before this government goes out of business at the end of March. I'm not sure they'll get there. But these two processes are now going on with the groups that did sign the ceasefire agreement. Those who didn't sign are welcome to sit in on the talks, but I'm not sure that many are doing that. After the signing ceremony, the WA, which have an autonomous region on the China border and have by far the most armed forces in opposition to the national army, they called the non-signatories to a meeting in their capital of Pangsan, and they suggested to them that they ought to start a separate process in anticipation of a new government that would take the talks straight into a political dialogue. The WA were not willing to come into the national ceasefire. They have a bilateral ceasefire with the army, but they did not want to be part of the national ceasefire, probably because it would require accepting the Constitution, which they don't do. The Constitution took away some of their townships that they claim. They also want to be they want to have status as a full state, and they're not. They're just an autonomous region in the Shan state right now. So they have some big issues with the Constitution and the government. But they would like to participate in the political dialogue in order to pursue those issues. So they've been pulling the other groups, the Kachin, the Kokang, the Hmong La in particular, and the Palong, away from the ceasefire talks. and it's not clear what's going to happen now, because there is, in effect, a separate branch now. The NLD, during the ceasefire negotiations, the talks were between the government negotiators and the armed ethnic groups. They did not include the political parties. And all of these ethnic areas have a very large number of political parties. I'm guessing that the NLD, once it gets itself situated in a new government, will be inclined to move beyond the ceasefire stage and start moving into a political dialogue and broadening the nature of the dialogue to bring in political parties and civil society, so that you have the armed ethnic groups, but you also have a much broader representation from all of these areas. It's going to be very complicated, but it will be, I think we have to look at it as a process of establishing national identity. The people of the country don't really have a common national identity like we do here. And they need to have a very wide-ranging and freestanding political dialogue, I think, in order to begin establishing a national identity. And that identity will have to involve an equalization of the status of the ethnic minorities with the Bama majority, the ethnic state governments with the national government, and an equitable distribution of resources. Above all, this is about resources now. When the insurgency started many, many years ago, or the civil war, you might call it a civil war, it was about the fight on the part of the army was about holding the country together. And that was basically what Ne Win used when he took over the government, when he established the first military government. He was concerned about the country spinning out of control. The government in Yangon was losing control of the whole country, and he wanted to keep it together. That persisted through 1990. When the Than Shwe military took over the government, they concluded a series of bilateral ceasefires with the warring parties, and those turned into a design for getting at the resources in some of these areas, particularly the Kachin State. The Kachin State is the repository of probably the most concentrated set of natural resources in the country. It's jade, it's gems, it's gold, it's water, rivers, dams, lumber, trees, and Kachin State is right on the China border, and there's been a lot of illegal trade across that border. Chinese entrepreneurs from Yunnan have just been cutting down, or actually paying people to cut down all the trees and ship them over to China. The state is being denuded. The environmental damage there is really massive. And that's all happened just since that original ceasefire was signed in 94. So those original ceasefires have a very bad taste for the Kachin people. And that's one reason that the Kachin are having trouble coming into this new ceasefire. Furthermore, the military is still attacking them in the Kachin state. It's really a fight for territory. And until the military can get beyond the need to keep attacking these people, it's going to be very hard to make ceasefires work. I think the NLD is going to have a massive problem on its hands with the combination of the WA pulling things in one direction and the Tutmadaw pulling things in another direction. I don't really see how it comes out, but it's going to be up to the NLD to negotiate some kind of an arrangement with the military in order to make it work. I can't be much more hopeful in that about the future of the peace process. Maybe Aung Din has some better ideas than I do.
Thanks. Thank you. Thank you for having me here. So I'm with the Wilson Center now. I moved from Singapore to D.C. last summer. But thanks for having me here. It's a pleasure. I would like to continue this broad overview with the role of the parliament. What can we expect of the next legislature? As you know, the NLD will control the two houses of the Union Parliament and at least 10 of the 14 local parliaments. But first, you may have noticed that the outgoing parliament is still in session. The constitution indeed does not outline any mechanism to dissolve the parliament, so this current parliament must go until the end of its five-year term, so that is late January. And this lame duck session convened on Monday and will probably last for several weeks. There are about 50 draft bills still in the pipeline, 16 in the lower house and 33 in the upper house or in between the two houses. It's a lot. Among the draft and proposals that have been discussed, especially this week, one deals with the suppression of Prostitution Act of 1949, another one with a new organ donation law. An amendment was put forward 2 days ago by the Home Ministry, which is controlled by the military, an amendment to the Indian Arm Act of 1878, which is still in force in the country. So it's a mixed bag, and there's a lot of debate going on. But the most important discussions deal with the budget of next year, as in every parliamentary system. When the end of the fiscal year approaches, ministries try to secure more funds and more money for the next fiscal year in Myanmar. So it's the fiscal year starts on 1st of April, so when the NLD government will start. And the current government has submitted supplementary budget requests for each of the 36 ministries, and currently the MPs were told to discuss those requests in their corresponding committees in the two houses. Then what? What will happen next January? 85% of the elected MPs currently sitting in Parliament will leave the Parliament. So only 15% of those elected representatives will remain in the two houses. And among the NLD MPs who regain their seats, many will probably move to cabinet position or be appointed chief minister, so we'll also leave Parliament in sometime in March or April next year. So we'll have a brand new Parliament filled with a majority of first-time lawmakers. Ong Din mentioned that with the NLD, so with little experience of the legislative process. That will probably mean that the party, the NLD, and the military on its side also, because they remain, they keep their 25% of seats, will be at the core of the process, of the legislative process, not the MPs, at least in the first few sessions. The first task of the new parliament will be the election of the two speakers on the very first day it convenes. We should not, I think, overlook the role of the speakers. Turao Shweman and Kin Ong Mien have showed over the past 5 years how influential the legislative branch and could potentially be, and how seriously MPs also took their oversight functions in particular. Aung San Suu Kyi, in theory, can be elected Speaker of the Lower House, where she grabbed a seat again. I thought it would have been a good, a reasonable option for her with a USDP-led government. But now we'll have an NLD-led government, and given the fact that Aung San Suu Kyi obviously wants to control the executive branch, control the president, and run the government, you just need to read the last interview that she gave to the Washington Post to be convinced of that. It would probably be considered a breach of the separation of powers if she leads the legislative branch and becomes speakers, and at the same time control the presidency and run the government. So this might be quite tricky. So I doubt now that she will run for this speakership. There might be other NLD MPs, Ong Wing Min, for instance, but I think it's safe to say that we don't know who will be the speakers in both houses next year, next January. The speakers and their deputies will then supervise just a few days after the election, at their own election, so that would probably be the first week of February, the presidential election. Here again, I won't speculate on who will be the three presidential nominees. Like everybody else, I would probably be wrong. But the NLD grabbed 390 seats in the two houses. And unless a handful of results are overturned, which is a possibility, the Electoral Commission will be swamped with complaints in the next few weeks. And as in during the previous election, right after the November 2010 election, a few results were overturned, eight actually. So there is a possibility that the this is not the definite number of seats that that we have today. But at least the NLD can now select two of the presidential nominees and secure the presidency, but probably not the first vice president. The army candidate, if he gets the USDP votes and a few other ethnic votes, may become the first VP, the first vice president. Then the president will have 2 months to form the government and appoint the 14 chief ministers. But the parliament will probably start its work right away while the horse trading for cabinet position takes place. But unlike 5 years ago, when the legislature starts from scratch in a very quiet and boring way, this time the legislative agenda will be really congested and packed. As I said, there are currently 50 draft bills still in the pipeline, and we're not sure how many will be passed before the end of this current legislature. So the upcoming House will probably be swamped with new proposals, especially if the NLD wants to act fast and quickly pass new legislations of its own, especially symbolic ones, or repeal old laws, especially the most repressive ones. But many questions remain, and I will just outline a few of them and leave it here for discussion after. First, will the NLD enter right away into a constitutional crisis and launch a new constitutional reform procedure right away? When the NLD chose to run for the 2012 by-election, that was the main goal of the party, changing the constitution. But now, and we can see that through the manifesto that the NLD released in September, so just before the start of the electoral campaign, the NLD is quite vague about constitutional reforms. This manifesto does not even mention the Article 59F, which bears Aung San Suu Kyi from running for president. The manifesto is very broad. It outlines some 25 pages. It's available in English also. There's an official translation. But it outlines many policy objectives, so that shows that the party is quite aware of the problems of the country, the state of the society and its economy, but also of the challenges ahead. But it's pretty light in specifics and do not really detail any concrete legislations that can be rapidly passed or prepared in Parliament. So we don't really know what and how the NLD intends to proceed right away. In that respect, the role of the new constitutional tribunal will be interesting. Its new members will be appointed by the president and the two speakers. There are 9 members, and they probably all will be closely affiliated to the NLD. Second question, so where to start? The new MPs and the new government, of course, will have a daunting to-do list, challenges after the election of the landslide victory will be to keep pace with that, with these huge expectations. The NLD may want to start repealing repressive laws that are still in place, enact a new number of progressive or new legislation to favor more freedom. But they will probably face a strong opposition from the military MPs, who may use the constitution to oppose some of these drafts, arguing that they could potentially prevent the defense services to fulfill their own duties as mandated by the constitution. So that's why the role of the tribunal will be key in coming month and in the coming session. Third, will the NLD MPs, or the government as well, address the most contentious issues of the moment? The citizenship law, for instance. Or the law ensuring the protection of race and religion that were signed by President Thein last August, these 4 laws that were really controversial. We're not sure. In the manifesto of the NLD, there are 2 issues, 2 main themes that are not dealt with at all. The first one is foreign policy. There's nothing about the NLD's potential foreign policy making. And second is religion. There is no mention at all of the place of religion in politics, according to the NLD. And fourth point, and I will leave it here, how will provincial legislatures behave? What will be their role? At least 10 of the 14 will be controlled by the NLD. 11, if we consider the Chin state Luto, if the NLD is able to strike a deal with the Zomi party. There will be one probably led by Rakhine nationalists in the Rakhine state, and the Shan and Kachin state parliament are going to be messy and very fragmented. But the NLD has promised to work to expand the work of those regional and state parliaments, and will probably also choose to appoint high members of its party as chief ministers and speakers of these regional and provincial assemblies. But we still don't know. The NLD policy is not clear about what they want to do. And as Aung San Suu Kyi usually says, you will see once we are in power. So I leave it here. And thank you.
Thank you.
Next. On the economy, the conventional standard of economic progress around the world is per capita income, GDP per capita. Along with some other economists, I prefer the standard of well-being, which is actually hard to measure, but is much broader than per capita income. And so what I'm going to do to start with is to put the economy in its historical context and look at the last 75 years of economic history in Myanmar by this standard of well-being, going sort of at 10-year intervals. So let's start in 1940, which I say is the high mark of the sense of well-being, economic well-being, in this country in the last 75 years. 1940, before the war, this is a country which was the largest exporter of rice in the world. It had some frustrations. It was under colonial rule, and there was a sense that sort of the money lenders, Indian money lenders, were sort of in control of the economy, or foreigners were in control of the economy, to the loss of the Myanmar people, Burmese people. But they also had first-class universities, first-class hospitals, doctors, and you know, well-being is partly a sense of relative to your neighbors, relative to other people in your region. And most experts I know say that in East Asia, the sense of economic well-being or the prospects, I mean, this country was in East Asia was doing pretty well in 1940. Okay, fast forward, 1950, 2 years after independence, the economy had been devastated in the war. There was a major reconstruction process going on. I would say pretty good sense of well-being because the country was free now. They were their own masters. 10 years later, 1960, not so good. The civilian parliamentary government had been dysfunctional. Economic progress was well short of expectations at independence or in the early 1950s, and the military was about to take over the country in a coup. 1970, well-being, pretty bad. This was 8 years of socialist rule. The modern economy had been nationalized. It was a sort of one-party state. By all economic measures, this was a country going down. 1980, even worse. Before the end of the decade, Myanmar would be declared one of the world's least developed countries in the world by the United Nations. And this was a period, the 70s and 80s, when the other East Asian countries were growing rapidly. So the sense of well-being, especially relative to the rest of the countries in East Asia, was pretty bad, going down. 1990, this was election year. There was and this that amazing election victory by the NLD. In the early years of the new, even after the election results were suppressed, democracy was suppressed, there was a sense of euphoria in the early 1990s because the socialist way had been abandoned, and the market was coming back, and there was more freedom of economic activity. So a sense of well-being sort of picked up, not back to, I would say, to 1940 standards. 2000, in the year 2000, this country was close to was on the verge of bankruptcy and was saved by gas, natural gas exports to Thailand. Also, sanctions and incredible political suppression. So while there was measurable improvement in the economy, the sense of well-being of the population, I would say, was pretty bad. 2010, another election year. I would say a better sense of well-being, but still, this was not the kind of freedom that people were expecting and wanted and so forth. Now, 2015, let me go mid-decade, 2015, this year. There is huge, I would say there was a euphoria on the economic, in terms of sense of well-being. This is a country which has been, feels maybe that it's been unshackled from the military. But I would say we are looking at a dual economy. You have a palpable sense of well-being in the cities and almost no progress in the rural areas. Under the Thein Sein government, a stagnant rural economy. And I would point out that there is not a single East Asian country that has broken through to middle income status without rising household incomes in the rural sector. Quickly, let me guess. 2020, what is this economy going to look like? Let me start with best case scenario. Peace process is successful. The political dialogue has succeeded. The NLD is doing sort of meeting the objectives of its campaign manifesto. I still believe that under this sort of best case circumstance, the economy will be mixed. There will be good money. There will be good phones. But there will not be good electricity and a bunch of other things, that there will not be sort of good institutions for resolving conflict and things like that. But there's also a central scenario. And the central scenario, I would say, is muddling along with a country that is sort of, in economic terms, performing more like India and Bangladesh than China and Thailand.
Thank you, Lex, and thank you to all four of you for putting a whole range of issues on the table. Before we open to the floor, can I just throw out a question for everyone with regards to foreign policy, because it was not something that was mentioned in any of the presentations. Understandably so, because I think that Myanmar is looking at a number of years at least of really domestic preoccupation with domestic challenges and consolidation. But having said that, do you have any thoughts about some possible trends we might be seeing or we might see with regard to an NLD government foreign policy? Yes, Priscilla. Please.
I can start that discussion. First of all, I think we can expect an NLD government to be looking to the West for a lot of assistance. The West has been the main supporter of the democracy forces in the country, and they will be expecting help. But I also expect that the NLD will write its own agenda, and it will tell donors what they want the donors to do. It won't be so receptive to donor suggestions about what they want to do themselves. I'm just guessing again. One of the big issues for the new government will be the relationship with China. China is by far the largest, most powerful, closest neighbor. They share a very, very long land border, and there is a lot of instability on that border right now. There's a lot of pressure on Burma from China, and they're going to have to figure out how to balance that relationship with the others that it has. I would imagine that this government will continue very much along the same lines of the foreign policy of the previous government and will remain very close to ASEAN. ASEAN is the security blanket for Burma, and I think they will continue to strengthen that. Relations with India will probably be quite good. Aung San Suu Kyi spent her teenage years in India. She went through high school there, and I think she will keep that relationship going. She did a year of graduate study in Japan, and I'm sure that that relationship will be healthy as well. So I think we will see, in the tradition of previous governments from the time of from the end of the colonial period, we're going to see a balancing of the country's relations with all of the great powers, trying to keep it evenly balanced. There'll be a lot of attention to the UN, because the UN has carried a lot of the water for the democracy forces and for human rights as well. But there's going to be one big issue that they're going to have to deal with, and I don't think they want to right away, and that is the situation of the Rohingya. This is of massive concern to the international community, particularly the West, the UN, and the Islamic world, to name a few. And they're going to have to face it. They're going to have to do something about it, as much as they don't want to. I don't know what they'll do, but Aung San Suu Kyi, in her interview recently, said that it had to be approached on the basis of rule of law. I'm not sure exactly how that works out, but I do think it is a reasonable start, because a lot of the problem has a legal basis, and it needs to be sorted out. That's my contribution to that question.
Thank you, President. Lex, you have.
Hong Din, do you have something?
Oh, you go first.
I'd like to say something provocative. When I started working on this country, one of my questions was, who's from the outside? Who is helping and who is really hurting this country? And as I look at what foreign aid agencies and international NGOs and foreign investors have done over the last 5 years, my conclusion is that on balance, they've done more harm than good. And my concern going forward is that with an NLD government, everybody in the world, if they're not already there now, they're going to want to be there and part of it to make a difference. I have an Australian friend who calls this the mad disease, make a difference. And they are going to absolutely overwhelm this new government. And that's so, I mean, when people ask me, well, should I go to Myanmar now? I say, unless you're going as a tourist, don't go. And I just hope I'm wrong.
Thank you. I agree with you, but we should not expect the next government to be an active foreign policy player in the region. We won't go back to the 1950s when Burma was leading the Asian Solidarity or Non-Aligned Movement. The focus is really domestic, so what's going on inside the country. So foreign aid, of course, the Rohingya issue, the relation with China, and the Chinese investment will be of concerns, but we can't expect the new government and Aung San Suu Kyi herself to be an active player in the region, in the South China Sea, for instance, issue or any other.
Well, in my view, in terms of foreign policy, the most important issue is in dealing with China. So, in case of China, I don't think there will be there are differences between the current government and the future government, incoming governments. So because Dong Suji also knows very well about this China, and she even said repeatedly that we cannot move from the neighbor. We cannot choose a neighbor. We have to deal with a neighbor. And then this neighbor is quite big. This neighbor is quite big. I don't think that she will choose to confront with China. She will try to find ways to work together with China. And also, she will try to make the balance between the Chinese influence as well as to counter the Chinese influence with the help of the other countries. And then the other countries, I mean the India, not the United States, not the Western countries, the India. So Burma is now between China and India, and they are both great competitors in the regions to get their influence. And then to counter the Chinese influence, the new government of the Burma might rely on the help of the India. Also, the relationship with ASEAN, I think the new government will maintain a very positive relationship with ASEAN and by working actively within the ASEAN communities. And then also, it's dealing with U.S., EU, and the United Nations. I think it will be very careful because I don't think the NLE and the Aung San Suu Kyi will not be very submissive to the demands made by the United States, EU, and the Western countries regarding the situation in Rakhine State. She knows very well about the situation in Rakhine State because she is a citizen of Burma. And she also knows how much pressure coming out from the United States, EU, and the Western countries. And she also knows about the feelings of the people in Rakhine State. So I think she will make balance to address the situation in Rakhine State very positively, and very humanly and very practically. But however she addresses the situation, it might not satisfy to everybody in the world. But anyhow, she will not be very submissive to the international demands. That's my opinion.
Thank you. Now we'll open up to the floor for a few rounds of questions. Can I request that you identify yourself before asking your questions? We have two hands, the gentleman here, and then sir, yourself.
Thank you for the learned and helpful discussion. I'm Tom Gettman, a longtime NGO executive, including some time in Myanmar. And in spite of what Lex has said, Priscilla was one of the best facilitators of good discussion when she was in her role in Rangoon, in her home with the NGOs. And I'm grateful for that, and long time I've needed to say thank you for that. So what about the role of the NGOs in the building of civil society, the ones that have been there for a long time, not the mad ones, but the ones that have been there that you worked with? Is there something to be said for the role, positive role, of the international NGOs that should be lifted up?
Absolutely. I think they've played a critical role in making all of this happen. There are two different kinds of NGOs, and I think Lex was talking about the ones that bring in big-time economic development aid. The NGOs that work with civil society and political parties and humanitarian situations will be essential, will continue to be essential. They have been essential for many, many years. During the time, 15 years ago, when I was the chargé, this was the bad old days. I mean, it was really buttoned down. It was a repressive military government. And foreigners were very, very carefully watched and confined in what they could do. And those who came in and worked in the country were quite brave, and most of them are still there now doing good work. And they know an awful lot about what makes the country run. They're some of the best sources of information. And I think that will remain, yeah. And I think they'll continue to play a critical role, because we shouldn't underestimate the value of what came out of these last 5 years. This USDP government that lost so badly in the elections You know, the Minister of Information said, ah, oh, they're just blaming us for the last 50 years. That's true, they were. But they didn't, if you take the election results, it seems like they didn't get any credit for what they've done. But they've actually done quite a lot. They made the elections possible. They ran fairly clean elections. They accepted the results of the elections, which didn't happen in 1990. And they opened up the country. They allowed civil society to develop. They allowed people to begin talking about politics, becoming active in political life, and that's what made these elections work. So I give them their credit for that. They did get tarred with the military connection, rightfully so. But at any rate, the NGOs, the foreign NGOs of all colors that have been in there working for so many years have really helped enormously to lift up the civil society and make it as vibrant as it is today. And I think that will continue.
Thanks. I'm Steve Hirsch. I'm a journalist. Priscilla, I was interested in what you were saying about the talks with the ethnic groups possibly expanding under the new government. I'm wondering whether, in your opinion, on the one hand, the NLD and NLD-led government now has common goals towards relations between the Burmans and the ethnic groups, and whether whether you think the NLD government going into broader talks has
mean common goals, common with whom?
Internally. Does the government have?
It doesn't matter. It matters what Aung San Suu Kyi thinks.
All right. Well, do you think that Aung San Suu Kyi has enough in common with what the ethnics want that agreement is possible?
Yeah, I think that she's as yet an unopened book on this. She more or less avoided the process so far. Didn't really participate much in it. NLD people did. Whenever I was there at the Myanmar Peace Center for events, there were always NLD people there. I mean, senior CEC, and they were close to what was going on. And one of the chief negotiators is a longtime NLD supporter, and so they were always well informed about what was going on. But I think that she was uncomfortable getting too closely associated with the government process, the MPC government process, because it was so focused on the ethnic armed groups and not the political parties. And I think, I'm just guessing that I think she'll be more inclined to broaden it and bring in political parties so that it's not just a discussion between armed groups.
But you don't think that there will be such a split between Aung San Suu Kyi and the government and the ethnic groups that they won't be?
Well, she will be the government.
Okay.
Who knows whether the MPC will continue in its current form. We just don't know. It may get transformed into something quite different. The process is largely supported by foreign money in any case, and so the donors are going to have a hand in helping to decide how it moves forward. I sympathize, actually, with that idea because I think there's been too much emphasis on the armed groups and that it has led to a splintering of the political element among the ethnic minorities, and they need to be strengthening their political parties. We saw the effects of that in the election. The political parties really didn't carry a lot of weight, except for the well-established ones like the SNLD and the ARCON, and they have more of an NLD connection than USDP. It's really hard to tell, but as I said earlier, my concern is the threats to the process. Not how the process is going to go, but the threats to it. And I think the threats are very serious on the part of the WA, who may or may not be encouraged by the Chinese to split off. The WA, the Hmong La, and the Kokang, there's this idea floating around that they would form their own separate state high, separate from Shan State and become a buffer with China. Whether that's real or not, I don't know. But every now and then things come out that lead me to believe that it really is something that's being discussed seriously. And that, I think, is a big threat. The Tutmadaw will really have problems with that. And they are key to getting peace agreements. The Tutmadaw are key. The National Army is key. And so the NLD, Aung San Suu Kyi, is going to have to reach some kind of an accommodation with them if they're going to achieve an end to the fighting. They may be able to move forward with political discussions, but an end to the fighting is not in sight.
Let me add a few things. One of Aung San Suu Kyi's close aides, Dr. Tim Yu Win, he is serving on the board of the Myanmar Peace Center. So when the MPC asked him to join on the boat, he did get the permission from Aung San Suu Kyi. That's why he serves on the boat. So he participated in all the meetings held in the MPC. He knows very well about the process of MPC in terms of peace agreement. So they are ready to pick anything left behind by the outgoing government to continue the peace process. But you're right that even though she is in the government, she must have a discussion with the military to make the peace process successful and ongoing. So right now, the military has shown its impatience against KIA, and so that's why it has launched severe offenses in Kachin State, fighting with the KIA and the other two ethnic groups, Daum Palong Liberation Army, as well as the SSA North. So I think Aung San Suu Kyi might engage with KIA first to convince the Burmese military to stop fighting. Right now, I understand that KIA leadership, they are also willing to work with Aung San Suu Kyi. Actually, they have accepted the contents of the nationwide ceasefire agreement. Yeah, they don't argue with that. They like the contents of the NCE. What they argue is about the inclusiveness of all the ethnic armed groups, which the Burmese current government refused to allow. So when Aung San Suu Kyi takes over the power, I think there will be direct communications between the Aung San Suu Kyi's government and the KIA, and then they will have some kind of understanding to start the fighting in Kachin State. If she wins the trust of the KIA, and then I think she can convince the Burmese military to stop the fighting, and then she can continue the peace process forward.
Thank you. Cambria Hamburg with the State Department. Given her massive mandate, do any of you see any realistic path to an Aung San Suu Kyi presidency? Say the military, for instance, the military MPs decide that they'd rather deal with her directly as opposed to a proxy. Can that even happen technically in the next 5 years?
Thank you to the panel. My name is Emily Vargas Barón. I'm with the RISE Institute, and I've been working in Myanmar for several years. I have a question about the social sector for development in the coming years. Over the past 3 years, Aung San Suu Kyi has been following very carefully the development of policies within the executive branch. Some of the policies and strategic plans have been very strong, some not as strong. What do you anticipate will be some of her efforts? Will she continue and expand and greatly expand investment in the social sector, or will she tend to follow a more economic investment point of view, which might, if it's uninformed, leave out the social sector? So I'm interested in your observations in general about the executive branch, but also very especially in the policy area.
I'm Dennis Helfand from the U.S. Korea Institute at CICE, but I worked for 13 years on the Foreign Affairs Committee. My question is about congressional perceptions of Aung San Suu Kyi. I was still on the committee when she got the Congressional Gold Medal, and those limited numbers of members of Congress who pay close attention to Burma, she was being honored for two reasons. One is as a Democratic leader. She's now checked the box on that with the elections. But the other was as a human rights icon. I mean, she'd won the Nobel Peace Prize. And I know the expectations, like my former boss, Ileana Ross-Leighton, was a refugee from Cuba. The concerns about the Rohingya and other ethnic minorities, and then Senator Lugar, both because of constituent concerns of having Burmese refugees in Indiana. He sent his staffer when he was still on the Foreign Relations Committee, Keith Luce, to Malaysia, who did a famous study on Malaysian immigration and selling Burmese refugees for enforced labor to different Thai concerns. So my question is, does Aung San Suu Kyi and the NLD realize that as far as congressional and perceptions in that legislative part of Washington, she has checked the box on democracy, but does she know how important it is to check the box on human rights and minority issues? Because when she gave her remarks at the gold medal ceremony, she didn't say much. Almost nothing about the Rohingya or minorities. I think later on in London, she made some limited remarks later that year, but people in Congress were listening to hear that, and they didn't hear that at the time.
I might start, but I think we also need to hear from Aung Din on some of these questions, but Aung San Suu Kyi as president, it's interesting, in her most recent interview, which was with Lally Weymouth, she said basically position doesn't matter. It doesn't. What's so important about being president? What's so important about being speaker? She said, I'm going to be leading the country. And I think she's not looking so much at the formal position she'll be in as the informal position. No matter what formal position she's in, she's going to be, by virtue of that huge mandate that she has with the people, she's going to be leading because she thinks that they expect her to do that. They expect her to crack the whip. They expect her to stand up to the military. They expect her to stand up to the cronies and, you know, and speak for the little people. And it's going to be a really, really hard road for her. So particularly since she's not allowed to serve in the position as president, I have a feeling that she's better off not being president for a lot of practical reasons, because I don't think she could manage that unruly bureaucracy, or let's say unmovable bureaucracy. It's not so much unruly as it is too much imbued with military mentality. On the social sector, I think we're going to see her paying a lot of attention to that, yes. She's going to probably try to move budget in that direction more than it has been, but it's not easy to move those things. It's all controlled by the government. It's not a private sector issue. We have, in our social sector, we have a lot of private sector involvement. It's only government's just one part of it, but there it's all government. And so you have to have ministries that are responsive and that actually get things done, and that's easier said than done. I don't know how long it's going to take her to do that, but I think we'll see a lot of emphasis on social sector and less on the business sector. Although there could be a kind of a banking crisis early on, I think we need to keep our eyes on the economy, because there are some big problems brewing there coming out of the reforms of the last 5 years. As for the Congress, I think that Aung Din just sort of gave us a clue that she's going to have her own approach to resolving those internal questions and not necessarily accept the narrative of either the U.S. or other international actors on the question of the Rohingya. In many ways, I find that there's a lot of misinformation floating around that has affected the way the international community is approaching that problem, and I think she's probably going to try to pull it back in, as Aung Din said, and find their own solution to it.
Just one point on the Constitution. It took 15 years for the military and the previous regime to write it, to draft and elaborate the whole constitutional order. Last June, the military MPs vetoed most of the proposal for amendments. So why would they change right now, right after the election? It's the military has set parameters and they don't some red lines and they don't want to move forward just because the NLD won. Now we have a face-to-face dialogue between the military and the NLD. Probably that's what the military wants. The USDP now is put to the sideline, and it's really a face-to-face dialogue between the NLD and the military. So they won't go forward.
Let me try to answer the questions. The first one is about her presidency. The question is that whether military will deal with her directly or with her proxy, because she said that any president will be under her. Right now, I look at the situation, then I notice that military and USDP, they are not withdrawing from the power happily, but reluctantly. So I don't think they will make her presidency by amending the Section 59F easily, because they don't want to see her success. So they were trying to deal with her proxy instead of her directly. And that would make more chance for them to make her ungovernable to the country. Right now, for example, let's say there will be an early president selected by her, and she's trying to stand above him or her. There will be a lot of constitutional conflict. Like Renault said this morning, that this president might be impeached by the parliament for violating the constitution if she listened to the orders of his or her party chairman. So there is a great chance for the military to make her ungovernable the country during the 5 years term. Now they are looking at the scenario in Egypt. You know where Egypt, they have the democratically elected government, and later he was deposed by the army, and the army came back to the power. That will be the great example for the military and the USDP. They will try to come back in the next 5 years, but within 5 years, they will make her a lot of problems, and they will make her ungovernable. I think this is what I think they are going to do the way. That's why I don't think they will let her be the president, and they will deal with her directly. Then they will prefer to choose to deal with her proxies instead of her directly. Investment and social sector, you know, it is her priorities to increase the budgets for health, education, and social welfare. So she has to fight. She has to fight within the parliament when the budget comes for the debate. The military, to increase the budget for the social sector, she must reduce the budget for the military spending. So how much she can bargain, how much she can win, I don't know. But since she has a super majority in the parliament, she can win by cutting the defense budget and increasing the budgets for the social sector. But if she does, there will be great fight between the military and the NLD. So then it will have the best civil-military relation, which might lead the country to a chaos. So I don't know how she will play the game, but I think that's why she tried to have a dialogue with Senior General Mia Online before the parliament, new parliament begins. She might want to convince Mia Online for the positive cooperation in which she might try to increase a budget for the social sector at the same time to reduce or maintain at the current level of the defense spending to be agreed by the General Mia Online. But I don't know how she will make the deal, but this is a quite interesting process to see how much she will be able to increase the budget for social sectors. And human rights. Dennis, I worked with you for many years when you were at the Congress. And I also appreciate that Congress have given the great honor to our leader, Aung San Suu Kyi. And she is quite grateful for that too. But I don't think she will put herself a burden to give a return for such honor. She will appreciate that Congress have give that highly respect to her, and she will be happy that the Congress gave her the greatest honor. But she will not bear the burden unnecessarily to put on her shoulder to return something for the members of Congress. And she knows very well about the Congress' major concerns. She also knows about the war is how the war is watching on the situation in Yakan State. And then yesterday, the UN General Assembly adopted a resolution calling for the country to recognize and give the citizenship to the Rohingyas. Also, a few days ago, there was so many articles regarding the ethnic cleansing or genocide about in the many media newspapers. She knows very well. But when it comes to this question, she has to work within the country. She has to work with her own people. So there are two issues. One thing, to recognize the Rohingya as a citizen of ethnic of Burma. Number two, to keep them the full citizenship. So I think she will choose the second one, okay? She will choose the second one. She will not agree with you guys to recognize these people as an ethnicity of the country of Burma, because most of the people of Burma don't accept it. So she will not stand against her own people. But she feels that these people must have the right to have the full citizenship. She will work on that. I believe so. So, yeah, she is a citizen of Burma. She knows the situation very well. She also knows that this is the first issue she has to address when she has a power. So she will address this as humanly and as practically as much as possible. That's thanks.
Lex, do you want to add anything?
No.
Okay, a second round of questions.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, sure. She has the privilege.
I have a question for Renaud. You mentioned that the Constitutional Tribunal will become very important in resolving some of these issues that the military may try to work through the parliament. But the Constitutional Tribunal changes every 5 years, too. So isn't the NLD going to have
yes,
a big...
They will appoint
They'll
their
put their
members.
Own people
yes.
to the Constitutional Tribunal. So what impact will that have on military attempts to?
We don't know.
I just wanted to raise that, because it's not going to be the same tribunal we have now, which is heavily controlled by the military.
Right. Yeah. But I'm sure that, nonetheless, the military will try to play that constitutional card.
Yeah, they will. But the size of the NLD mandate in the parliament is so big that they will basically control the non-military institutions that relate to the parliament, I think. And I haven't thought it all through yet, but I keep coming back to these questions, and I'm sure she's thinking it through, that they've got to get their own, particularly in the area of legal. She cares so much about the legal system and its weaknesses that I'm sure she's thinking through exactly what she needs to do to start sorting that out. Because she keeps coming back to that question, whether it's the ethnic minorities or the Rohingya or anything else, she keeps coming back to the legal question, rule of law.
There are also a lot of lawyers around her within the NLD, so they most probably will be appointed to key.
Whether she listens to them, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's take the questions on this side first for the first round. Two here,
Hi, Prashant Parameswaran with the Diplomat magazine. Two quick questions. So I wanted to first return to what Aung Ding said earlier about the election outcome itself. So I don't think anybody, you know, before the election predicted a supermajority for the NLD or even how badly the ethnic parties did. So my concern is not about the predictions and, you know, what we got wrong and what we got right, but I'm just wondering, it might be too early, but what can we learn about any structural factors, things that we missed, about what accounts for this very interesting and unexpected outcome? And then secondly, given the NLD's supermajority, as well as its influence, and the fact that the international community vastly underestimated the NLD's popularity, what does that mean, if anything, for U.S. policy, whether it needs to be readjusted? Right. Well, let's just restrict it to the United States. And let's say, you know, what does that mean for U.S. policy in terms of, is there any recalibration? What are the next steps in terms of the engagement with the NLD? Because as all the panelists, I think, have suggested, there's a delicate balance the NLD has to walk between making sure it doesn't alienate the military, but then also making sure that it gets things done so that in the next election it can still maintain its popularity. Thanks.
Lynn Kwok, Brookings Institution. Thank you for that. My question related to the peace process. You mentioned earlier, Priscilla, that Aung San Suu Kyi would probably seek to leapfrog the ceasefires into talking about moving into political dialogue. What are the chances, you think, of a sustainable peace, given that two interest groups in that process would have their power reduced? So you would have the ethnic armed groups who would see their power diluted, given that, you know, she'll be dealing with a broader group of representatives from the ethnic states. And also the military, who have always in their approach, I think, seen ceasefire as necessary before we can even start talking about political settlement. So do you think that a sustainable peace is a likely outcome, or are we going to see increased tensions and possibly fighting?
I thought I said it was going to be a problem.
The first question.
Policy?
Yeah.
Yes, there will be some changes in U.S. policy. It's not clear what they will be. I think it's going to take a while, but the administration is already thinking of that. They were anticipating an NLD win. I mean, I don't know what you meant by we all missed it. I don't think anybody thought the NLD wouldn't win. It was just a question of how much. And as Aung Din said earlier, people who watched the USDP develop over the last 5 years came to the conclusion that they were actually more competent than we expected, and that they were out sort of trying to be a political party, and that they would do better than they did. What people misjudged was the strength of the public on this. And if you went into the country beforehand and talked to people, they seemed to be disinterested in the elections, but they weren't. So I think it's a matter of the way you approach polling, the way you approach questioning. They don't respond in the same way that people do in Western societies. They're not direct about it, and people misjudge that. I suspected at the time that there was a lot of misjudgment in the polls that were being done by Western organizations. When I went in and talked to, for example, NLD groups in local areas, they got it right. They told me how many seats they expected to win and why. And I see that they know what they were. They knew how to ask the questions, and they were doing some very clever house-to-house polling and that sort of thing. They were doing a lot more than we gave them credit for. People would go in and see the NLD looking basically disorganized at the local level, but they weren't. Many people who are looking at Myanmar today are newly arrived at the scene. They do not understand the dynamics of the country internally. It's a very complicated place. On U.S. policy, yes, there will be some changes, but I don't think we're going to see dramatic changes. I think it's going to be a process over time. There are a lot of things that have to get sorted out here, because the fact of an NLD government is a new reality here, and it's going to take a while to digest it. On the question of the peace process, there are huge problems, but I do think that she's going to try to move it towards a political dialogue, and I think she can do that with or without the military. And I think that she doesn't want to get totally hung up on the ceasefires and totally hung up on the armed ethnic groups. The armed ethnic groups are not Democrats. Let's understand that right up front. They never have been. And many of them had no interest in these elections and weren't even going to allow them to happen in their territories. So we shouldn't look at them as, you know, the saviors of the country. They have got to be brought along, and I think that she feels that the Democratic parties, that the ethnic minority parties are more inclined towards, you know, a Democratic dispensation, and they need to be in the dialogue. I agree with that. I think there's too much emphasis on the armed groups.
The first question about the social fetters. I think I mentioned in my, remarks saying that I underestimated the magnitude of hatred and anger by the people against the Burmese military. Also, I can also add that the people are so sick of the propaganda wars of the ultra-nationalists and extra-religious kinds, so such as the Organization to Protect Race and Religions. So some Buddhist monks and also many ultra-nationalists, they have been campaigning for USDP 2.0. They reach out to the ordinary citizens and they say, okay, don't vote for the NLD, because if NLD wins election, then the Burma will be under the influence of the Muslim community, so and so. They have been a lot of rumors and negative campaigns against NLD nationwide. But people are so sick of hearing from them. People are so sick of such ultra-nationalist, voices of ultra-nationalists. Now, this election results show that they rejected the people of Burma, most of the people of Burma rejected these voices from the ultra-nationalist extremists, religious extremists. And then you just look at the Yakan State. Yakan State, there's a north and south. There's north is an area that where the Rakhine people have their hold the highest nationalism. They are very strong. And then the southern part, they were very flexible. They are not strong. So when Dong Zhansri went to Yakan State, she chose to make the campaign speech in the southern part of the Yakan State. And she wins. Her body wins 8 seats in 4 townships in Yakan South. But the other Yakan body, Arakan National Party, win on the Yakan North, all together 22 seats. So this is a kind of her popularity. She went to the, you know, the dangerous territory. She explained herself to the people about any misdoubt they have upon her after listening to the voices of the ultra-nationalists and religious extremists. But finally, she wins over all the hatred against her. And ethnic minorities, they are very divided. Divided means that they found so many bodies. For example, Chin State, there are 12 Chin bodies. And then even within the body, there are a lot of fight. A lot of fight for the ranks of powers or whatsoever. So they can't even trust each other. That's why they could not even convince their own constituents to trust them. That is why they lost in this election. I don't mean that they all lost. Arakan National Party wins significant numbers of seats to control the Yakan State Parliament. Also, the Shan Nationality List for Democracy, it also won significant numbers of seats in Shan State. But those are not enough to control the Shan State Parliament. But anyhow, the most observation about they are lost, it they are divided. They are not trusted each other. They are also under the influence of personal interests. They have to refound themselves before the next 5 years. The U.S. policy. I don't know how much it will change to the U.S. policy, but it was quite obvious that only just after the elections, the U.S. Ambassador Darren Mitchell visited to Naypyidaw. He met with UEC election chairman Ugo Ting-A, also the President Thein Sein, and the Commander in Chief General Meng Aung Hlaing. So it was quite obvious that United States have faced so much attention on this election. And tomorrow in Manila, I think President Thein Sein is now flying to Manila for the APEC meeting, and President Obama will receive him for the one-on-one meeting. So I believe that United States has paid highest level attention on the situation in Myanmar, and that is why there will be kind of the policy reviews within a few weeks before the new government takes over the power. But I don't know how they will change, they will adjust the policy. We will wait and see. And peace process. Right now, the Myanmar Peace Center is rushing to move forward with the ongoing process. Actually, there is a schedule already written within the Nationwide Ceasefire Agreement. Once they sign a agreement, within 2 months, they have to have the framework meeting for the political dialogue. And within 3 months, they have to start the political dialogue. So they are working within this time frame. But some members of NLU were not happy about this. Why they are rushing? Why they will leave us to continue this process? There's some kind of misunderstanding. And some elements within the NLU really hate the embassy members. So I don't know how it will happen, but it is a process that is moving on by the current government, and then NLU has no choice but to pick up whatever they have left when they take over the power.
Quickly, I want to go back to the matter of the NGOs, because I don't want people to misunderstand me. I believe NGOs are doing a lot of good work in this country. But let's think about governance for a minute. I mean, well-being is determined largely by the governance of a country. It's easy to pass laws. It's easy to make policies. It's not so easy to implement policies and laws. And therefore, and you know, it's governments that implement policies and laws, not civil society. So think about state capacity. We're just talking about a country where state capacity is about as low as you can get. And what happened, and I would say that international community has not worked hard enough to develop state capacity, the capacity of the government to implement policies and laws and so forth. I'm also concerned that the NLD will factionalize very quickly. Factionalize, and this is experienced in other countries. It will factionalize, I think, within the first 2 years. And another thing to look for is how long does it take for the new members of the parliament to raise their salaries? So one has to be a little skeptical here about how democracy operates in this country. And in particular, I think we will see absolutely money politics, ruling politics in this country in the next 5 years.